Welcome to our Goldster Podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're looking at the art of novel writing. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.
So it just remains for me to welcome the fabulous Joanne Harris. I'm so excited to have you on this. Joanne, welcome to Goldster. I'm sure you need no introduction, but for those of you who may not be aware, Joanne has written 19 novels, I believe it is, including, of course, Chocolat, the novel that made you incredibly famous. She has written all sorts of wonderful things, different, and I know this isn't a great word, Joanne, genres, covering from kind of mythology. Apparently, she's in religious fiction on Amazon, which I find absolutely hilarious. The Chocolat novels, some fantastic four psychological thrillers, which I'm just reading the last one at the moment. Please don't tell me the end. And of course, Chocolat was turned into an Oscar-nominated film starring Juliette Binoche and Johnny Depp. She's also written cookery books. The fantastic recent book, it's a mosaic novel, Honeycomb. Really, really loving it. And a non-fiction book, which we're going to talk about, which is great for all those of you doing our writing course on Goldster, 10 Things About Writing. Novellas, including one about Doctor Who, short stories, screenplays, game scripts, libretti for two short operas, and a musical. This is absolutely astonishing. So I just can't believe that you've written all this, all these things, Joanne. That's quite incredible.
Well, I'm not sure I believe it either.
And it's so great to have you on board. So first of all, I really need to know, are you bilingual with so much French in your work? And do you write in French as well as in English?
Well, French was my first language. And so, yes, I'm bilingual. I still speak French to my parents at home because my mother's accent when she speaks English is still very, very pronounced. And she doesn't encourage it. If you can speak French, she will speak French to you. I've written various bits and pieces of journalism in French, but I'm not tempted to write my novels in French because, you know, selfishly, I get published in a lot more different countries if I write in English. If I wrote in French, I get the feeling I'd just get published in France.
Maybe in Canada.
Maybe.
So when you write things in French, for you said you write journalism, do French newspapers respond well? Are they big fans of your books? Do they welcome you as half French?
I don't know. I don't think they do, actually. I think I've battled with the French publishing industry for them to actually speak French to me, because what they would really like is for me to be much more English, because they think that Englishness sells. I remember going on one tour to France where I went to nothing but English bookshops. And I thought, well, you know what, if I really wanted to sell books in English, I would have stayed at home. So that there's that feeling that, you know, I should be very British. And if I'm not very British, it's a bit of a disappointment. But no, I've got plenty of readers in France, and I get lots of letters from French people and lots of people on Twitter speaking French to me, which is nice. But the industry itself has not been especially responsive. I think actually I sell more in Italy than in France.
Oh, wow. And that's hilarious about your trip to France, because those of us who aren't bilingual, I mean, my French is very schoolgirl French, and I wasn't lucky enough to have a good teacher like your mum when I was at school, so it's very bad schoolgirl French. And actually, when I go to somewhere like France, I wish that I could speak to people in their own language, and I feel, you know, terrible that I'm speaking in, you know, mostly in English with the occasional foreign phrase. So how funny that they don't capitalise on that and really use your bilinguality.
It's very odd. I'm constantly being complimented on my French when I go to France. And I go, well, you know, it's fine. Thank you. I'll take a compliment. But it was my first language. I'm quite happy to be complimented on my English, because I found it quite hard to learn that when I first started. But I picked it up okay since then.
Oh, right. Well, next time I see you, I shall compliment you on your English and say how well you're doing. So your mother is French and your father is English. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. And recently, you've just recently published your fourth thriller in the St. Oswald series. And if you haven't read Joanne's psychological thrillers, you must. They're absolutely gripping. This was inspired partly by your childhood and partly by your time as a teacher. Is that correct? Could you talk to us a little bit about that? And how
the thing about teachers is when they, they marry other teachers and all their friends are teachers and they end up talking about teaching all the time. And so being brought up by two teachers and being my grandfather, my French grandfather was also a teacher, I was surrounded by teachers from an early age. And so teaching stories were very much a thing of my childhood. And I got the impression as a child that teaching must be terribly exciting because it was full of drama and gossip and scandal. And so I collected teaching stories almost unconsciously throughout my childhood. And because my parents kind of assumed that I would be a teacher, I was genetically bred to be a teacher, I kind of became one, almost in spite of myself, and found that I liked it and that I was good at it. And that actually I knew more about teaching when I started off as a junior teacher than most have in decades of teaching, because I'd had all this previous experience. And I realized that schools are kind of factories of stories. And because I write about communities, essentially, and because the community that I happened to be part of was a school community, while I was writing my early books, before I quit my day job to do this weird, unpredictable thing that I do now, I would take various aspects of the community around me and use it, which is why when you look at Chocolat, you can see a fair bit of the place that I was. I was teaching in a boys' grammar school called Leeds Boys' Grammar School. And it was a place that was mostly filled with teenage boys and elderly gentlemen of a certain type and of a certain persuasion. And when I arrived there, aged about 25, one of, I think, four women members of staff, it was a bit of a learning curve for me. I'd just come from a big, busy, comprehensive school to this boys' school. I hadn't really wanted to teach in a single-sex school. I hadn't particularly chosen to teach in a private school either, but I ended up there. And it was a bit of a learning curve getting into that groove, I think. It was not immediately easy for me.
And you told a wonderful story in an article recently about wearing a trouser suit
on your
school. Do tell us that, because I loved that.
Well, I mean, this was the late 80s, so it wasn't all that long ago. But yes, I bought this navy blue trouser suit because I'd been told that, you know, we were supposed to look presentable, and I couldn't just slope in wearing any old thing. And so I bought this trouser suit. And the third master, there were two deputy heads. There was the second master and the third master. And the third master was this little wizened man who lived in an office and who would just pop out like a trapdoor spider and grab people and haul them in if they'd done something bad. And this happened to me. And I found myself in front of the third master and he said, "Mrs. Harris, you are wearing trousers today." And I said, "Yes, so are you, third master." And he said, "No, but here, ladies at Leeds Grammar School wear a frock or a skirt." And I thought, okay. So the next day I turned up in a red PVC miniskirt and thigh boots rather earlier than I normally would, and went into the third master's office and said, "As you can see, I'm wearing a skirt as per the LGS uniform regulations. And if you felt that it was possible that you could update these regulations, then I've also brought the trouser suit." And he looked at me with intense hatred and said, "Wear the pants." And I never heard anything about uniform at all after that. It was one of the many ways that some of these men in power just would wind me up and would bully me. And I kind of double bluffed him on there, because I would have had to wear the skirt the rest of the day if he'd said no.
Oh, yeah, that would have been fun.
I was ready to do that, and I think he knew it.
Yeah. Well, if he'd called you up, wow, that would have been incredible. None of them would have forgotten that lesson. You can be sure they'd all be
on
here. They'd have joined today to meet you again. So when I've been reading that, I trained very briefly as a teacher when I was an undergrad, and you just capture, and I know we've probably got quite a lot of teachers here in the Goldster community, and it took me back to doing my undergrad teacher training and that atmosphere in schools and the intimidation you feel as a young teacher coming in. It's wonderfully created. I really love it. We have a comment here saying, "Joanne, I had a similar experience about wearing trousers at Carlton Primary in Barnsley, but in 1974. So kind of 15 years on or whatever, nothing had changed, obviously."
Not at LGS, it hadn't. No, it was quite a traditional place, and it had actual gargoyles on the building. I had a room in the bell tower. And such was their faith in my staying power that the blackboard in this room was very high because previous master had been very tall and I couldn't reach it. And so instead of doing what anybody normal would have done and bringing the blackboard down to my height, they just decided I wasn't going to stay for long enough to bother with that. And so they just put a box so that I could stand on this box. And I used to loom over the boys in this little room in the bell tower, scratching on my blackboard, standing on this box like some kind of pirate on the deck of a ship. It was ridiculous. And there were pigeons and there were mice that would come out into the form room. It was like teaching in Gormenghast. And in spite of everything, I got to really love the place and to enjoy its eccentricity and the long running soap opera that was the common room and all the people in it.
That's given you such great fodder for your writing. So for those people who haven't read it, would you tell us a little bit about the St. Oswald series and what plans you have? Did you plan it as a series, or was it supposed to be a one-off? I mean, how did it come about?
No, I didn't plan it at all. In fact, I was never going to write about teaching. I said to myself, I'm not going to do this because it's all too close to the truth. And you know, I have colleagues who are still alive and who might be upset if they think they recognise a situation or some facet of Leeds Grammar School. And so I didn't do it for a long time. And I wrote other things. And then I found myself writing a book called Gentlemen and Players, which was set in a grammar school. Not entirely unlike Leeds Grammar School. It's called St. Oswald's and it's also in the north of England. And I found myself speaking in the voice of this elderly Latin master called Roy Straitley. And it was so easy. I just found myself doing this voice so easily and being able to access the character of this person. And so I found myself writing a revenge thriller. And I thought that until I'd finished it, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to carry it off because it was based on twists and revelations and misdirections. And it was just things that I hadn't done before. But I just enjoyed that voice and that environment so much that I wrote another one and then a third one. And I realised that without quite planning it, I'd written a trilogy. But I think looking back, I think this was inevitable. I had always been writing about Leeds Grammar School, regardless of whether I was writing books set in a school setting or not, because that community was just so interesting and there were so many characters there. And so much of my development as a writer kind of ran alongside to teaching. And so it was inevitable that it would sneak its way in there. So I kind of finally burst out and said, yes, OK, I'm going to write about teaching now. And so now I've written my trilogy and I've no idea whether I'll go back to that environment again. But I get the feeling that, you know, it's a kind of homeopathic dose of teaching to remind me why I left.
I think that's a very, very good idea. Now, Carol has says one of my favourite books ever, Great Ending. I think that's probably Gentlemen and Players that you were just talking about. And we've also got another comment. It happened to me too in 1971. The other lady members of staff encouraged me to set the standard because they desperately wanted to wear trouser suits in a primary school. And you think as well, when you're in a primary school, you spend your whole time kind of running around and bending over. Trousers are so much more practical for a teacher than a skirt or a dress in most circumstances. Yeah. So I'm going to take you back a little bit to Chocolat. So Chocolat is the novel that just made you famous. How did that feel to write a book that suddenly was so loved? And everybody suddenly knew your name. What was it like? And had your publishers expected it was going to be this phenomenon?
I didn't have a publisher.
Oh, tell us about that then.
I'd had two previous books published by two different publishers. But because they were different from each other, you know, the publishers hadn't felt that they'd wanted the second one, and the third one, when it came, they didn't want that either because that was different. And so, you know, Chocolat was kicking around from one publisher to another for some time before someone took a punt on it. It was not considered to be an obviously commercial novel. I think the problem was they didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it was because I didn't know that I was supposed to stick it in a genre. And so they weren't sure whether it was literary, they weren't sure whether it was magic realism, they weren't sure whether it was supposed to be this or that. And I wasn't sure why they needed to say anything, why they couldn't just bring it out as a book, which they did in the end. But no, it was a very odd thing, because I'd been told that that was not the kind of thing I should be writing, and that that kind of thing wouldn't sell. So having been told that I shouldn't do it, of course, I went ahead and did it. And Chocolat then emerged from my reaction against the people who had been telling me what I ought to do. I think that looking back at my career, a lot of it was actually based on doing the opposite of what I was told. That seems to have done me quite well, actually, over the years.
I think that's brilliant. And coming from a teacher as well, that's even better. So where did the idea for Chocolat come from? Was it something you'd been thinking about for a long time? Or was it something, a dream that you had? Or did the character suddenly appear to you?
Not really. I think what happened was I'd written two novels that were not quite in my voice. And I was still searching for something that I wanted to write about that wasn't a pastiche of somebody else, because I'm very good at pastiching other people. But it took me a long time to actually evolve a confident voice of my own. And with Chocolat, I think I'd come to the conclusion, I'd just become a parent. My daughter was, I think, 3 when I started writing Chocolat. And I'd suddenly realized that I was beginning to be more interested in other people than I was in myself, which is probably a sign of maturity. And I wanted to write something about my family, my odd French-British family, and some of the things that I remembered from childhood. And I went, because I was teaching still at Leeds Grammar School at that time, I went on a school trip. And we took the boys to France at Easter. And I remember thinking how different Easter was in France to what it was in England. And it got me thinking about the folklore of Easter and how it feeds into other areas of belief, and the strange dichotomy between fasting and feasting. And I thought, okay, I'm going to just riff on this and see what happens. And so I started to write it, and it came very quickly, actually, because it's, on the whole, a simpler story than what I'd done before. And I ended up writing it in about 4 months.
Wow, that's so impressive. And then it took quite a long time for you to find somebody who was interested in publishing it. When you say quite a long time, how are we talking, kind of years or months? Or?
No, I didn't try it. Of course, it was my agent who tried it. But I think it took her some months to get an interest, and then all of a sudden it kind of acquired momentum, and yeah, I went off on holiday with my husband and our daughter to Ireland at the half-term holiday, and this was at the same time as the Frankfurt Book Fair. And when I got back, I realised my agent had been desperately trying to get in touch with me, because all of a sudden everybody was buying this book, and it was the fair's hot property. And I thought, well, this is new. This has never happened to me before. What will it lead to? I'm still kind of reeling, actually, from all of that. It was very unexpected.
We have a comment here that says, I'm so glad you did write Chocolat. I was brought up as a strict Catholic. It was fascinating to see this other way of being. I'm very glad you wrote it as well. I loved it. We've also had a comment saying, what subject did you teach?
I taught French and German. And occasionally I got roped in to teach Latin. But at LGS, the departments didn't generally speak. And so if you taught one thing, usually you stuck to that one thing.
And we've got asked as well, at what age did you start to learn English? And were you born in England or France?
I was born in England, but my mother didn't speak English. And so we spoke French at home until I went to school. And then I picked up English because I had to.
So was that a bit bewildering, going to a school where everybody was speaking a different language? Do you remember much about that?
I remember being surrounded by children who wanted me to speak French to them, and that wasn't the problem. I also remember being asked by the headmistress to translate. I was about 5 at the time, to translate for some visiting dignitary from France who had come to discuss some kind of exchange either sense, for me, there was just this woman here who put me out of class and wanted to talk to another woman. So I talked to the other woman, but I didn't do any translating. Instead, I think I remember telling her mostly about a beetle that I had in a matchbox, which had dropped behind the radiator. And there was a lot of stuff about the beetle and very little about what the headmistress wanted me to say. But, you know, I think at five, you don't really understand the concept of translation.
No, of course not. Why would you? You just think, oh, this is nice. I can just chat to someone in the language I speak to with mum.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think it's hilarious. They wanted you to translate. I hope it wasn't anything really important for the future of the school.
Yeah, I just if you're going to do that, I would think don't ask a 5-year-old.
I think so too.
Probably.
So when Chocolat became this huge success and it was turned into a film, what was that like? Did you just get one phone call? Did you have lots of people vying for it? And what did it feel like? Did you enjoy the casting? Did you take any part in that?
I think initially it was a very remote possibility that it would be made into a film, because what happens is that generally people buy up book options when they're cheap and they either use them or they don't some years down the line. So this option was taken up before the book was published anywhere for a very small amount of money. And I was led to believe that, you know, most options don't get picked up, and so I shouldn't get too excited about it. And then I started to get calls about it, and then the script was in development, and then all of a sudden I got a phone call out of the blue from Juliette Binoche saying, by the way, I've been cast in your movie, at which point I realised that the movie might very well happen. And then I went on set, and then the movie did happen, and then I went to the Oscars, and all that seemed to happen over a very short period of time. So I didn't have much scope for adjustment, and although it was a ride, it was fun in places, it was also quite destabilizing, because I'd only just stopped working at Leeds Grammar School. I'd reluctantly taken a sabbatical so that I could actually deal with all this other stuff that was going on in the book and the film world. I'd only just admitted to myself that I wasn't going to go back. And that was already a big decision to me, because, you know, I was giving up a job that I knew and that I liked and had a proper pension and that my mother approved of to do this completely incomprehensible thing that I wasn't sure I could sustain. And so there was that to cope with. But also, I think, you know, the degree of scrutiny that I underwent at that time was just completely unprecedented. I wasn't used to the newspapers camping outside my door. They did this. Wow. While I was in London, when the movie got up for the Oscars, a whole bunch of newspapers camped in front of the house, this little house in Barnsley, at the end of a cul-de-sac. And my husband kept telling them, no, I wasn't there. And so, no, I couldn't talk to them. But they didn't leave for another 2 days. And they used to try and follow him when he took our daughter to school down the road. Yeah, this was completely... To me, it was a surreal thing.
Yeah.
I'm not very comfortable, honestly. I didn't really like that aspect of it. I still don't feel entirely comfortable when there is scrutiny from the press, because, you know, to me, that I am not interesting enough to warrant that kind of thing, and I don't have anything to give them that they really want. So I'd much rather they just read the books.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a bit like with the kind of the Olympics, isn't it? When suddenly everything gets turned on these athletes and they're trying to find out everything about their lives. And you think, well, what you should be interested in is their sporting abilities. It's the same with authors. You know, the book is the product. That's what they should be asking you about, not trying to find out things about you personally. It is an uncomfortable.
It is, but I've got used to it now, and it's less of a shock. But I think at the time it was genuinely... It was a culture shock, a world shock, and it just kept on happening, because the book was a bestseller, and then I got used to that, and then there was the movie, and I got used to that, and then there was the Oscars, and I got used to that, and I remember thinking, you know, what's going to happen next? What is the world going to chuck at me next, and how uncomfortable is it actually going to be?
So the
whole of that year, I went through a phase of just... of having these incomprehensible panic attacks where I just passed out.
Oh, wow.
Invariably in some kind of glitzy venue. So I've passed out at 3 movie premieres and 2 royal palaces. and it's just, you know, it was just like narcolepsy. It was like Tony Soprano. I would just pass out and then just wake up on the floor surrounded by flunkies or something. And that would be, that was it. And I realized a year later when I'd stopped having them because the pressure was off, that that was probably what it was. It was a kind of tilt reaction to stress.
Wow. That's fascinating. Well, I hope you don't still have them now.
No, I never had them again. I got used to it. My whole life was overwhelmed at that point, and then I got into a slightly quieter way of doing things and managed to deal. But yes, it was exciting, but sometimes a little overexciting, I think, in that respect.
So did you go to the Oscars?
I did.
That's exciting.
I did. I borrowed a frock and I went to the Oscars, and it was a very strange experience. And I think I wrote about it for some newspaper. I can't remember which one now, but I remember saying that it was very like school speech day, but with better frocks and much more boring, because actually a lot of the Oscars is waiting for things to happen and then waiting for something else to happen. And of course, everybody dressing up in evening dress as if it's evening when actually it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because you're doing this in LA for the benefit of New York, which is in a different time zone.
Of course.
So, yes, I got up close and personal to a lot of very famous people, and some of them benefit from this and some of them really don't. So it's quite strange.
And what did you think about the casting? Did you have a say in the casting at all? And did they become the characters that you thought they were, or was it just very strange seeing your characters being played in a totally different way from how you felt you'd written them?
Well, I wouldn't have had a say in the casting. I think if I had been a very established author and if they paid a lot more for the option, I might have been able to wangle a say in the casting. As it was, I had no say in the casting at all, except that I kept going on about Juliette Binoche at a time when they were considering other people. Now, I don't flatter myself that actually they changed their mind for me. I think it was an interesting little piece of synchronicity that meant that I had been saying that Juliette Binoche should get the part. Juliette Binoche read the book, realised they were casting and asked for the part. But I don't think it had anything to do with me. I think it was just one of those rather nice little pieces of happenstance. And to me, the fact that they did choose a primarily European cast was a really good sign, because initially that's not what they'd wanted at all. They had a whole concept around how they were going to deal with the book, which meant taking it back in time to the late 1800s, setting it in the American Deep South, and casting Whoopi Goldberg. And I thought, okay, they're going to make it a race fable. That's really interesting, but it's not quite how I envisaged it. And then they decided against this. I think they couldn't get Whoopi Goldberg. And they decided that they were going to set it in New York with Gwyneth Paltrow. And I thought, wow, you know, is anybody going to believe that Gwyneth Paltrow eats chocolate? So once we finally did get Juliette, who does eat chocolate and who actually spent a fortnight working in a chocolate shop so that she would be able to handle the ingredients and deal with them looking professional.
Fantastic.
I thought, okay, they've understood that this is how it's going to look. And so it ended up coming much, much closer to my original concept than they had expected it to in the first instance. I saw some very strange iterations of the script where all sorts of things were going to happen. But eventually it came back to being about three quarters of the book, which is good, I think, for an author, because sometimes the story goes so far from the original source material that it's almost unrecognizable, which I think is a bit sad.
Yeah. Now, how great. We've got a couple of comments in the chat. So let me just. So Joanne writes so well in so many different ways. Do you plan quite far in advance what you might write next, or do you wait for light bulb moments? Or are you prompted with ideas, stroke themes, and characters at unexpected moments? Thank you for this wonderful and fascinating talk. And Joanne, have you a favourite recipe from your cookery books? Now, that is a long question.
There are a lot of questions.
There are a lot of questions. Thank you for that.
I think initially the ideas thing, it's never as planned as people think it is. I don't plan ahead in that way. What I do tend to do is I collect ideas and I rattle them around, sometimes for a very long time. And then they get shared out, and sometimes they get repeated, because very often what I will speak about in one book in one way is addressed in the next book in a different way, and in the next book a different way again. And so everything that I do is thematically linked, even though it might not seem particularly close in terms of genre. Because what interests me, and it doesn't really matter whether I'm writing fantasy or whether I'm writing literary fiction, those ideas that interest me are still going to keep coming back and will penetrate the story. As for my favorite recipe, no, I don't think I do have a favorite recipe. I think what I like about recipes is that they follow the change of the seasons. And so I will have seasonal favorites, and there will be things that I like to make at particular times of year. And I wouldn't think of trying to make it other times of year, because some things are just not in season and won't be as good.
We have another question here. Wants to know if you met Juliette Binoche.
Yes, I met everybody. I was on set for a week or so, and Juliette came and stayed at my house and went over the script with me. And so I spent quite a lot of time with her, actually. And, you know, we talked about her part and how she wanted to interpret it and how I saw the way she would interpret it. And so, yes, I got to know her, and it was very, very nice working with her. And she's singular in that she is really interested if there is a source material that's a book and the author's around and available. She is really interested in getting the author's impressions, which I think is not normal for most actors. Most actors will want to bring themselves to a role, whereas actually I got the feeling that Juliette wanted to bring what I saw to the role, which was refreshing and rather wonderful.
And Sue says, I was so pleased that you followed up Chocolat with Peaches for Monsieur le Curé. Excuse my terrible accent. I so enjoyed both books. Thank you for that, Sue.
Well, that's great. I'm so glad. You know, there are four, you know, that there are four of them.
Yes.
I never intended to write any sequels. And I mean, in a sense, they're not exactly sequels, because there's quite an interval of time between them all, but they're all certainly connected. And so, yeah, there's four. There may well be more after this, because obviously Vian's children have grown and have stories of their own. So I may go back to them for that.
Yes, if you've only read the first two, you've got another two to go, everybody, just so that you know. What are the key things you focus on in your first draft of your manuscript?
It's a good question, but that's not how I operate. I don't do a draft which focuses on something specifically and then to another draft. That's not the way it works for me. Generally, my first drafts are quite clean. So it's probably because of the way I do things. My general process is that I will write a certain number of pages. I don't count words. I don't do anything like that. But every day I will read aloud what I wrote the previous day. I will edit that usually quite fast. And by that time, I will be back into the zone, the tone of what I'm writing, and I'll be able to continue. And so I do this. So the reading aloud thing to me is the best editorial tool that I have. And it helps me to make the first draft reasonably clean. If there's anything wrong with the first draft, usually it's structural. Because by the time I finish doing what I do, line by line, it's usually fairly good and it doesn't need a lot of picking apart. And because I don't generally start a book until I've got the character voice properly in my head and therefore the characters are in place ready to go, I don't generally have to work too hard on characterization in the second draft. So I'll generally do, you know, one draft for me, a redraft for my agent, a redraft for my editor, and that's usually all I have to do.
And another question from Anne, where do your characters come from? Is that even possible to answer?
Well, they come from everywhere, of course. Sometimes I will take aspects of people that I know. When I was teaching, I took a lot of aspects from colleagues and pupils that I taught and people that I interacted with on a daily basis, because when you teach in a school, sometimes you see more of your colleagues than you do of anybody else in your life. And so some of those figures found their way into the books, and some members of my family found my way there. And my daughter's in there, of course, my daughter Anushka, who is not unlike Vian's daughter Anouk. And sometimes just people that I meet. sometimes random encounters with people, and they will tell me something about themselves, and I'll think, you know, you belong in a story, or that story belongs in a story. But everybody is different. Everybody is a kind of composite of other people. I don't generally lift somebody out of real life and put them in a story without changing anything. It's more like casting for a play rather than accurate portraiture.
So you mentioned briefly earlier about genre, and I know we've talked about this before, that how frustrating it is that publishers expect everything to fit neatly into a genre. And I love the fact that you write in lots of different genres. So you're very fascinated by fantasy and fairy tale and mythology. I'm really enjoying Honeycomb. Do you want to tell us a bit about Honeycomb, which I hope people have heard of, but if not, this is a fairly new book by Joanne, and I just think it's fascinating. So tell us about the structure and why you decided to write it in that way.
Well, I wanted to write a collection of fairy tales that were original and that were at the same time modern, but also which spoke to the memory that we have of classic fairy tales from the golden age of fairy tales. And I wanted it to be an illustrated book for adults, in the same way that the books of fairy tales that I loved as a child, the ones that were illustrated by golden age illustrators, were not really for children. They were for adults. And I thought, okay, nobody's doing this. And I had been telling fairy stories on Twitter, which is a whole different story, for some years. And initially, I just told them as kind of Twitter ephemera. And then I started keeping my stories. And I realized that not only did people like them, but also I was writing them in a very particular way. I was writing them because they were designed to be written in tweets. I was writing them with a brevity and a regard to the structure of the sentence that I wouldn't normally have had to use if I'd been thinking in terms of paragraphs instead of in terms of little slices of 140 characters. And so, having collected some of these stories and having realized that they had themes that intertwined them and that they had overarching storylines and returning characters, I thought, you know, what if I put this into a book and give it a shape and a sort of overarching narrative? And what if I tried to write a novel that was also made up of individual singular stories? Because I was writing about a honeycomb world of many possibilities, and because bees and the stories that the bees tell are also very much a thematic part of the construction of the book. So I thought, yeah, I'll do it like this. And every story will be a cell, and every cell will touch some other part of the story. And pulling back to look at the entire completed structure, people will realize that this is one thing made up of many things. And I thought, okay, maybe people will get this and maybe they won't. But it was my excuse to try something new, and also to work with an illustrator that I love, Charles Vess, who I can only find the American edition of the book, I'm afraid, but he's illustrated this, and it's just his artwork is just astonishing. I love him. He's one of the few remaining living fairy painters.
Beautiful.
Who actually believes in fairies and who therefore is very, very much the first person I thought of when I was thinking of writing an illustrated book. But yes, it's been lots of fun working on this, and it's a book that ties in with other things that I've written in the same area. I've written some retellings of child ballads in novella form, and I have three of these now, and they all fit into this honeycomb world as well. And I've been really enjoying subverting and twisting and gender flipping old ballads from the 17th and 18th century and making them mean something different now.
Well, I'm really enjoying it, and I think I'm thoroughly going to recommend that to everybody. So you've had three books out very recently, haven't you? So within a few months of each other,
You had The Strawberry Thief, which I think is the fourth in the Chocolat series. Is that right?
Yes.
Honeycomb, and then the fourth St. Oswald's book, A Narrow Door. They all came out, is it last year or earlier this year?
They came out last year. The Strawberry Thief came out in paperback, and the other two came out in hardback, yes, during last year, which...
So no book
seems a lot thing, but people were very hungry for new books, I think.
I think so. Yes. And I think that reading, you know, there's all these wonderful figures about how reading just had a boom in lockdown, and how people were wanting to buy real books as well. And all the, I remember going
reading
to...
and writing too, actually. Yes. There was a lot of interest in that.
There was a huge amount. And I remember going to a bookshop when they were allowed to open, and you could just go and pick up your deliveries, and having ordered a whole load, going to pick them up. And it was absolutely joyous because it was about the only thing that was open in the town apart from the supermarkets.
Somebody just asked if the books are on Kindle. Yes, they're all on Kindle.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I can't have them show you, because they're all on my Kindle, unfortunately. But, so... I wanted to ask you a little bit as well, because I first met you with the Society of Authors. So the Society of Authors is something that I'm very, very fond of, and I know you are too. So would you like to tell people what it is and what your role is? Because you've now got a very important role.
Well, the Society of Authors is basically the trade union for authors of any kind. So authors, illustrators, poets, translators, screenwriters, anybody who is published or about to be published is eligible for membership, and writers who are not yet published are eligible for associate membership. And it's a very good organisation. It's very old too. It's been in existence for a long time and has had some really astonishing members. But I think, you know, writers don't generally make a lot of money. They're not generally great at business. And the Society of Authors is there to protect authors' rights, to make sure that their contracts are fair. I always send my contracts, even though I've got a very good agent who shouldn't be making any mistakes, but I always send my contracts to be vetted to the SOA. They lobby Parliament for various issues concerning authors and their rights. We recently had some success getting authors to be paid for the sale of secondhand books from certain places, because obviously secondhand books are great for people who want to buy secondhand books, but authors who make a living from selling books don't generally get paid from them. So, you know, we managed to spearhead an author share scheme, which means that now some secondhand outlets are paying authors a percentage of sales, which is a wonderful thing. You know, that there are all sorts of ongoing campaigns. And of course, in the lockdown time, when a lot of authors were either having their contracts pulled and were not being published at all by their publishers, or their publishers were in trouble and were publishing fewer authors, or some people who just make their living mostly from doing live events and from going to schools and doing readings there, those people lost a lot of their income. So the SOA has an emergency fund, which was there basically to tide people over. And we gave out over $1.25 million last year. And we're likely to do the same again this year, because there's been a tremendous amount of hardship in the writing community. And so, yes, the SOA does lots and lots of different things, but is really a very good organisation. And I'm the chair of the management committee, which is basically the group of directors who look at how the SOA works and who regulate its finances and try to give it a direction that serves its members.
So we have a question here by somebody who started writing children's picture books in lockdown. Well done. Is the Society of Authors an American society? No, it's UK, no. And there is a UK website. If you just Google Society of Authors, it will come up. Do follow them on Twitter. They are excellent. And if you have any queries, you need any advice, please get in touch with them. And I say that heartfelt, because I've also been on the management committee, and I'm really grateful to the Society of Authors. So Joanna's absolutely right. They are a lifeline, and they are our union. They are wonderful. One of the things I remember being very pleased about when I was on the management committee was finally literary festivals started. All of them started paying authors, almost all of them. And people who were buying tickets at literary festivals didn't realise that we weren't being paid. And, you know, the biggest one would be the worst offenders. So that was great to have, you know, to have, not to mention any names, but to have the society backing that and to really making it widely known so that people were saying, oh, I'm paying my £5 or £8 or whatever. Why isn't the author getting any money? So it's a really great organisation.
No, it's been very good, I think, and has been doing wonderful things over lockdown. There have been some really good virtual events throughout the whole of the summer. That have been so good and so accessed by so many people that it's obvious that there was a need for them. And yes, the SOA always having great ideas like that.
They are brilliant. Anyone who is a writer, anyone who's an aspiring writer, please look them up. And you may well be eligible to join. You can join as an associate member if you haven't yet had anything published. So please do look them up. And we have a comment. I don't know why I thought you were so much older, probably because you've written so much. Great.
That's nice to hear. Thank you.
So the other thing we have to talk about is Twitter, because you are basically the queen of Twitter. You pretty much own Twitter. So one of my favourite tweets that I remember, it was probably from a couple of years ago, somebody tweeted, I think it was a bookshop or something, tweeted that you were back after 7 years with a new book, after taking a break, I think they said. And you tweeted back and said, I wasn't taking a break, I was writing it. And I just thought that was the best response. Because, you know, they just think that authors, if a book isn't out at that moment, they're not actually working. They're just sitting in the garden with their feet up.
No, I think that's true. I'm not sure people really understand what a lot of writers do. Mostly it's writing. Bringing out books is nice, but mostly 99% of the time it's writing them.
So you've done a wonderful series on Twitter of, you know, you do your 10 things. You've got your 10 things about writing book, I think, there to show people, because I think a lot of people would love this.
You can take the teacher out of the school, but you can't take them out of teaching. And so I found that on Twitter, I was answering a lot of questions that were basically teaching questions about teaching creative writing. And I would do these in Twitter threads, and I would call them 10 tweets, and people would just do requests. And I realized that I was getting the same questions over and over again. And so I thought, I'll make these things public. And, you know, I'll do little seminars every few days and we'll discuss editing or time management or character development or whatever. And finally, I succumbed to all the people saying you should put this in a book. And I wrote this book. In fact, I wrote it very fast because most of it was written already. Yeah. I wrote it over the first lockdown because I realised that there was a tremendous renewed appetite for writing tips. And I realised that people who had been furloughed or who were on lockdown were finally using that time to perhaps explore the possibility of improving their writing or writing that book that they'd always wanted to start and hadn't quite dared. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to go with a small publisher who might need the support, and I'll bring it out as an ebook straight away, and then maybe later as a hardback, so people can use it straight away. And it was nice to see so much interest in that.
So you said you often get asked the same questions. What were the things that people were burning to know? What did they keep asking you?
Well, you know, one of the things I get more and more is, how do I know that I'm a real writer? How do I know that it's okay for me to start? And so actually at the very beginning of the book, I wrote a chapter about this. I said, you know what, the most difficult thing about being a writer is giving yourself permission to do it, because so many people are just very hesitant and they think that, you know, it's not for them, or they'll be laughed at, or people will not take them seriously, or they'll be disappointed, or something bad will happen if they try to start writing. And I try to say in the first chapter that people write for all kinds of different reasons. Not everybody wants to be a pro. That doesn't mean that you don't have to take it as seriously as somebody who is a pro, because, you know, these things are absolutely personal, and they're driven by passion and joy. And you can get huge amounts of joy from writing, regardless of whether you want to do it as a job or whether you ever want to be published. And if you do, then all the better. So I thought, you know, I would try to make it as inclusive as possible. And I also did these little 15-minute seminars on YouTube to accompany the book. I think I've got about 20 of them now, just to try to encourage people to think of themselves as somebody who can be a writer if they want to. absolutely, because all you have to do to be a writer is write.
I always say that to my writing students, because people always put themselves down, and I've had people produce beautiful work and they'll hand it in to you and say, oh, it's not very good. And I say, well, probably the only profession, and we all do it. I mean, we all panic all the time about agents and publishers and readers and reviewers. And I say, you wouldn't get a plumber saying to you, well, I've just fixed your bath. It's not very good, but I've done it anyway. You know, or an accountant wouldn't say, well, just done your accounts, but you know, I'm not sure if you're going to like them. But for some reason, the personality of people who go into writing, we're always constantly putting ourselves down. So for all of you doing the Gold Star Writing course, I know there are many of you out there, please take Joanne's advice. You are allowed to write. And also, why not buy her book as well? 10 Things About Writing. So we have a comment here. I worked in a school library and encouraged the librarian to buy Joanne's books for the staff and students to read until I retired 2 years ago. I hope you're enjoying your retirement. Now I need to read them again and to catch up and curl up with the latest ones. That sounds like a very good plan for the winter.
And sounds great.
We have a comment. I see writing as sharing a piece of your soul. I think that's very true. That's possibly why it's so hard for us to put it out there.
I think so, yes. And I think it's a very percipient comment. In a lot of ways, writing is about making yourself vulnerable. And I think that some people are genuinely and rightly afraid of doing this, but it's actually one of those things that a writer has to push themselves through, because if you don't make yourself vulnerable when you're writing, then it is likely that what you're writing will not be authentic and won't connect with the reader in the way you want it to. And it's a lot of people ask me about this. They ask me about dealing with criticism and what I do to deal with criticism and you know, does it paralyze you? And that too is something that you don't necessarily see as a problem, but when it becomes that, you just have to think, well, at least I'm doing this, and not everybody will like it. But if one person likes it and sees something in this, then I will have done a good thing. But yeah.
We have a comment here, which I think is really interesting. I write, but I hate the thought of my children reading what I write.
Oh, I hate the thought of my mother reading what I write. But, you know, I mean, sometimes that's, yes.
And what?
Yeah, I think.
Sorry, what did your mother think of Chocolat when it first came out? What did she?
I have no idea what my mother thinks of anything that I've written.
No, she doesn't tell you.
The only time she has ever expressed, no, she has expressed an opinion twice on my books, and I've written, I don't know how many I've written now. One was when I wrote The Gospel of Loki, and she said, verbatim, but in French, I read your book, it was funny. And I thought, wow, this is the first time she's actually said something about one of my books. And then she read The Strawberry Thief, and she said, I read your book. It is the book I wished I had written.
Oh,
I thought, wonderful. Wow. So my mother doesn't say much, but when she does say something, it's food for thought. I'm still thinking about that one and trying to figure out exactly what it is that she meant by that. But because it's a book about motherhood, I guess, it must have resonated with her on some level. But my mother, who was a deputy headmistress in her day and who has some very strong ideas about not flattering your children or making them big-headed, has never been particularly approving or praising of what I do, although my husband thinks she's proud of me. She's never actually said so.
Oh, I'm sure she is. Mothers don't always say it, but they mean it. So I believe she translated some of your works as well, or helped you translate.
She did, yes. Yeah. She did, actually. That means that technically speaking, now she works for me, which is wonderful. But yes, my I realised when Chocolat was translated into French, and I looked at the purported translation, it was so bad that I had to rewrite it completely from scratch. And I thought, okay, this can't happen again. I must have a say over who translates my books. And because my mother is a native speaker, and also she has a literary degree and she has a particular style in French, so, you know, she was very well equipped, I think, to translate my books. And it meant that we could work together and she could ask me any questions that she needed. And also she's very good at reading beyond the text and giving a resonance to the text, which is based on her knowledge of pop culture and song lyrics and information that only somebody of her generation would know. which is really important, actually, when you're talking about, let's say, the voice of Framboise in Five Quarters of the Orange, where I just don't think that any translator in their 20s would have been able to do that voice, because they wouldn't have had the depth of vocabulary to do it or the life experience to do it. And this is, translation is a very expert skill, and translators tend not to be paid all that much and not to be given very much time to do their job. And so it was important to me that the French translations could be as good as possible.
Yes, I totally agree. And I had never really thought much about translation until the first time one of my books was translated. And suddenly you realise what an incredible skill. And those of you who've been with Goldster for a while, you may well have met on Goldster Danny Hahn, who came a few months ago, who I know you know well, Joanne. He's a fantastic translator. And we were talking about the great importance of a translator being a writer. And that's, I think, what a lot of people don't realise. Unless you read a bad translation, you don't realise how important it is for a translator to be an author themselves, and such an important thing. So do think about translators if you're reading books. Not that we get that many translated books that really make it big here. Quite sadly, we're very kind of stuck in
It's a pity.
And publishing.
It is a pity, but actually we also have translated books and we're not even aware that they've been translated, because until recently, there was no particular drive to put the name of the translator on the cover of the book. And one of the Society of Authors' recent campaigns has been to get the translator acknowledged on the cover. Yeah. And actually, there's been some success here, and some publishers are now subscribing to this. And I hope more will do it, because it's really important. It's you know, it's like illustrators who should also be acknowledged on the cover of books and are not always. And they're very, very important.
And before we say goodbye, we're nearly at the end. I'm just going to tell people what's coming up, Joanne, and then I'll come back to you in just a moment. So tomorrow at lunchtime, at midday, I've got Inside Story with Greg Jenner. You may well know his name. We're talking about his new book, Ask a Historian, but also about his fantastic podcasts. You may recognize his name because he began with Horrible Histories on TV. He's done the podcast You're Dead to Me, Hilarious Histories, all sorts of wonderful things. And we'll be talking at midday tomorrow on Goldster. So if you're not yet a member of Goldster, please do sign up for the book club, and you can get all of these wonderful things. The book club is free to everybody at the moment. And then on Friday, Humphrey Hawksley, just for those of you who don't know, he's not my husband, I have to keep reiterating this, we're very distant cousins. Apparently people thought we were the Richard and Judy of the book club. I'm sorry, but we're not. And he is interviewing the Norwegian explorer and adventurer Odd Harald Haug, and talking about his book Everest, The Death Zone, and his other writing as well. It's going to be really fascinating. And then next week on the 20th, Humphrey is interviewing David Hewson, who is going to be talking about his book, The Garden of Angels. So visit Italy with them for that one. And then we've got travel writing on the 21st. I will be talking to Jeremy Seal. One of my favourite travel books was written by him. It's a book about Turkey with the fabulous title A Fez of the Heart. And his new book is A Coup in Turkey. We've got all sorts of things coming up. Now, you may have thought that the 20th was going to be Namita Gokhale talking about Jaipur Literature Festival and her books. That has been changed. So David Hewson has very kindly stepped forward. He was supposed to be speaking in March, and Namita is going to be speaking in March. That is because of the ongoing situation in India with the pandemic. Jaipur Literature Festival has had to be put back, and Namita didn't really feel that it was appropriate to come on while India is really struggling at the moment. So she is in India herself, and she just felt it wouldn't be very diplomatic. So she's going to come and talk to Humphrey later in the spring. And we've got David Hewson instead, who's very kindly stepped up. So thank you so much, Joanne. You have been, as I knew you would be, a wonderful guest. It's been an absolute joy to talk to you. And I hope that we can start Society of Authors events in person again at some point in 2022, because I have really missed it. We've got lots of lovely comments coming into the chat. Merci, merci, merci to both of you. Defo, enjoy. I love this, from all the French suddenly to Defo have enjoyed this refreshing interview. Some lovely comments. Thank you. Thank you, Joanne. Lovely evening. Love your books. A fascinating evening. Thank you so much. Thank you. Lovely to meet you, Joanne. Lovely meeting, Joanne. I've been thinking about giving writing a try, and you have encouraged me to have a go.
You should.
I think that's what we should end on. Absolutely, she should, shouldn't she, Joanne?
Thank you, everybody, for your attention. and your company and your lovely comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone. We're going to go now, so take care. And I will see some of you tomorrow. Please come along, as many of you as you can. And if you've enjoyed this, please tell your friends about Goldster. And if you are a Goldster member, see you soon. Take care. Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews, to expand your world, and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.